Hi, Internet. My name is Jonathan Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack
our feels
about Frank. That was it. But I wanted to let the audience know that I'm currently creating the front end, back end, all the ends. I'm taking the internet and I'm wrangling it to my advantage.
Yes.
And one of the ways that I'm trying to do that is to have this be a showcase for making Unboxing Story a platform that I can talk about storytelling. And if you personally like my opinions about things and think I would be a good writing partner for you to talk about what you're working on, I'm trying to make a streamlined way for you to hire me, whether it's a one-off thing, whether you want a couple of drafts of me looking at a thing, whether it's on a story basis or more just line editing. Because one thing I feel like about this podcast is I wanted to change the slogan yet again, although I'm obviously notorious for doing that. But unpacking fiction without the friction.
Oh, I like that.
Because this is somewhat inspired by my friend Will, who I'll sing his praises all day for inspiring that part of the of my opinion about storytelling. There should be a way to build community. It shouldn't be a way to create tribal rivalries, because there's enough of that in the world.
Yes.
And one thing, because of the differences between Melissa and I's tastes, it's come up numerous times that we have to remind ourselves, hey, we did this to have fun and enjoy talking about stories, not to, get in the weeds about, you like weird things about fairies, and so shame on you. the more we, and it, part of it is, I think, the nature of us growing as creative partners. So I wanted to make that something that I could offer to other people, where if you have something that you're writing, I think I'm going to ask Melissa to talk more about that on my Fiverr page and other people that I've worked with on their writing, that they can get across maybe how editing with me is a bit different, because I believe that you should agree on what you're trying to do first. And if, say, somebody comes to me with a zombie apocalypse story, I'm going to be upfront about the fact that, I'm kind of sick of that genre. And so, I might not be the best editor to come to. But say you want some cynical jerk that's, sick of those stories, and you want to say, no, my story is the best zombie apocalypse story. I got a new take on it. And you want to enter the gauntlet of my reading, then you're welcome to send over your stuff. So more on that in the future. This month is England's month.
Woohoo!
We're talking about the genius of writers like J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis. Was Chesterton one of them?
No, but I think they were very closely associated. Williams.
I'm going to kick it over to Misha because she.
Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and a few others, but those are the four most prolific ones, most influential ones, most notably Tolkien and Lewis, though the others academically were also very influential. Basically, they were a writing group, right? Like a peer critique writing group that met in the Bird and Child, is what it's called?
I think the Eagle and Child.
Eagle and Child in Oxford. They all shared a love of language. They did not necessarily all share exactly the same religious views, although they were mostly Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoyed the intellectual debate and, critiquing that each of them gave the other in this group. So they would basically meet up. Each of them would read something that they had written recently, and they would discuss what they thought, and produced some of the most well-known fantasy and speculative fiction that we have currently.
Yeah, and I think I've often heard from more literary fiction people that Tolkien is like the father of fantasy as we know it today.
Yes.
And so a lot of my talking points are more about reconciling what people have said about Tolkien and what personally I like, what resonates with me about his stories. Because in preparation for this month, I was listening to different things about magic. And it was interesting because, on an unrelated note, I was looking at people talk about magic rules in general, because I'm working on a fantasy story right now. And that same channel, I think it's his channel name on YouTube is Hello Future Me, did a video about Tolkien, and he was talking about some of the different emotional appeals in his work. And one of the things I think is interesting about, we talked on the Southern Gothic episode about how Tolkien was, he employed this eucatastrophic structure in which it seems like, you know, nothing's working. It seems like, you know, all is lost, and then there's some kind of miraculous thing. He felt like that was a good dramatic way to tell a story. But what's interesting is that this guy, Hello Future Me, was talking about how he used mercy within his stories. And while it seems like these big dramatic moments are about this catastrophic thing, and like, for example, Frodo at the end of the story, he loses. He gives into the ring, and so does Gollum. But because people had mercy on Gollum throughout the whole story, it was able, and those moments, if you don't really investigate the story to find, you know, those mirrored things. I know J.J. Abrams talks about thematic rhyming with Star Wars because there's, you know, Master Apprentice, and that being a positive thing about the story. But what's interesting about Tolkien stuff is that you have, you know, Isidore succumbs to the ring, Frodo succumbs to the ring, and they both pay this price for giving into temptation. And those are these big, you know, catastrophic things. You know, Frodo gets his finger bit off and Isidore, you know, gets, you know, shot to death and everything. So these are those big epic parts of the story. But then there are times when, you know, Frodo talks to Gandalf about, you know, why should we just let Gollum, you know, stalk us all this time? And so, like, it means a lot to me within that story that there's this thing where Gandalf's like, you know, we don't know what his fate is, to decide for him would be wrong. And it's a really powerful moment in the story to me. And it ends up having this kind of dramatic thing where if they had just killed Gollum on a whim, he wouldn't have tried to fight for the ring and then not destroyed it in Mount Doom. So there's a lot of that I really like within Tolkien's writing, that there's this symmetry in different stories throughout this big epic that he's made. But yeah, there's also different things like that, but I didn't want to steal your thunder. Let me know. I have a whole bunch of things because I put a lot of, you know, stock into the different, like we were discussing, like there's all these different tropes and stuff that he's used, but we also got into more in terms of his philosophy about things. So we're going to get more into the weeds about that later, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that a little bit.
Which part?
Just the types of stories that he wrote in comparison to
other
fantasy.
Well, like we said, he's kind of the first one that made it a thing. I'd seen discussions about this online about calling him the father of fantasy, when technically, I suppose, it's supposed to be George MacDonald, who is another one we might talk about this month. He wasn't part of the Inklings, but he greatly influenced many of them. The idea of writing these sorts of mythological level stories, right? Stories where there are beings that are not humans or magic, it being a real thing, was considered juvenile, right? Like, that was the stuff you put in fairy tales for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of writing stories using those tropes for adults was not known, really, until these guys started writing this sort of stuff.
Mm.
And then, of course, it exploded. Part of the reason why I think it exploded the way it did is because humans crave those kinds of stories,
mm-hmm.
right? We love mythology. We love this, like, making there be something more than the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
So, as opposed to science fiction, which had been huge already by this time, science fiction got huge, like, I guess in the Victorian era,
mm-hmm.
started becoming a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy had not yet. And maybe part of that is World War I happening, where now people want there to be a reason for all of this, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just because, I'm going off on a wild tangent here now. So
don't chastise yourself for your point. You're fine.
But, so science fiction is more of a taking a natural thing or a scientific principle or an invention or technology or something that people are doing,
mm-hmm.
right? And taking it to an extreme and showing it being either abused or what that would do to society or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So in the writings of, like, H.G. Wells or Jules Verne's, you get these, like, people losing their minds and using, like, nuclear submarines to,
mm-hmm.
you know, terrorize the world or whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like speculating on how the world could go crazy. Mm-hmm. And then World War I happened, and everybody's like, oh, this was totally not how we expected this to go down, right? Mm-hmm. This wasn't, oh, somebody taking a technological thing and trying to take over the world. This was a bunch of clandestine connections between countries in Europe, and it was this big conspiracy thing, and one guy gets shot, and the whole thing exploded, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was people being petty, really, if you boil it down to whatever that mess was. So now people are looking at humans like, oh my word, what is wrong with us? And they turn to this fantastical sort of literature. And it wasn't just necessarily fantasy, because I think this is when stuff like magical realism and other things in, like, Hispanic country started getting huge,
mm-hmm.
too. You want something more than this place, because this place obviously went loony.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Tolkien's world was born when he was in the trenches in World War I.
Mm.
So, sorry, all of that to get to some of the themes that I love
mm-hmm.
him for.
Well, I want to piggyback off that, basically to just agree with you, because we were discussing this during watching The Last Jedi yesterday, and because it was May the 4th, and also a lot of what we're talking about in terms of his opinions on fairy stories, we're hoping that you would join us on hashtag Read the Fifth, where we're going to do a BookTube YouTube discussion, post it, a video, and go over his essay on fairy stories. It's available online for free, where he really outlines all of the different opinions of where fairy tales have gone. That was back, you know, in the 50s. But I think a lot of it still holds true today. So yes, please join us at the end of the month. And Read the Fifth, because the fifth is a good mnemonic for me to remember. That's when I need to get to think. I was bringing up during Star Wars that a lot of these things, like Game of Thrones and Star Wars, have this, like, Dark Lord figure. And it seemed like Sauron, that was kind of a similar thing. But what's interesting about that to me is that, like Star Wars, there's this internal struggle of, I could become the Dark Lord.
Right,
like, there's a part of it that is a military battle, but there's but the also this internal, is, yeah. this personal journey of the hero realizing there's this dark side, and anybody is capable of succumbing to that. So it's interesting as there was a lot of trench poets that were struggling with nihilism, and their struggle seemed to be more this ambiguous thing of losing hope. Tolkien was somebody that said, you know, that you can defeat this evil that's inside of you. It's a more personal battle that you're fighting than you even maybe realize. And it's interesting when other people were going more towards sci-fi, and as we've discussed earlier in this podcast with things like Blade Runner and I have no mouth, but I'm a scream. I might be butchering that because it's a very long title.
Yes.
But there's very depressing short stories and novels that came out in the sci-fi fantasy genre that were very much focusing on how particularly bad society is, and seemed to be very caustic and difficult to read personally, because there's not very much introspection in them. And that's an interesting thing to me about Tolkien stuff.
Also, I'm not sure when those were written. Well, Blade Runner was... When was that? That was later, yeah?
Well, it's all kind of seen as the same school.
Well, no. Well, I was going to say, there is a marked difference in literature, all literature, after World War I versus after World War II. My one friend always gives me the example of, shout out to Katie, by the way, if she's listening, is before, after World War I, they wrote Our Town. I don't know if you know that play.
Okay.
It's a very hopeful play in some senses. There are sad things happening, but it is this hope from the afterlife, right? That things can be explained when you can see everything, the whole big picture.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to after World War II, you start getting stuff like No Exit and The Stranger,
mm-hmm.
and things where, no, this world is worthless. We're done. Because after World War I, people were like, okay, obviously there's something more going on here. We need to figure this out, but we still have hope. And then World War II hit, and everybody was like, we give up.
Mm-hmm.
Because World War II was so very much more horrifying. And they thought, like, literally after World War I, the way they talked about that war, they didn't call it that then, obviously. It was the Great War. They thought that was it. This was the end. That was the war to end all wars, mm-hmm. and we're going to fix humanity. And then World War II blew up on them. And they said, what in the world happened? Like, what did we miss? What went wrong? Mm-hmm. So, like, literature just kind of went way off the nihilistic deep end, because they're like, obviously humanity is gone. Like, it's over.
Yeah, I would I don't think that we're arguing necessarily.
No, I'm sorry, I'm very passionate about this point, because
I know that it, I know is, that it got was a worse.
Huge it was a huge thing that blew up in people's faces, and
but I think to your point, what we've discussed is that C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, I think, were ahead of their time in combating
this idea. Yes, in combating that idea.
And so there was a lot more, I think, that I probably haven't read that was building that up within literature. It could be that those authors aren't as prominent, and that's why I haven't, you know, read them. But there were, and that's one interesting thing about their literature, that it seemed like they were. Like, in my first readings of On Fairies, it seemed like he was already writing as if his ideas were under some persecution. And it's just interesting to me, because it's not like he, like today, where so much writing is overtly political. Whereas, you know, it seemed like during his time, there was a lot of sci-fi that was... like the Twilight Zone, where they're very simple morality-based stories. And then when you get to, like, the 60s and 70s, that's when they get very frightening and difficult to read, because, you know, there's, you know, robot slavery and, like, a lot of very oppressive ideas. So I think you're right in the sense that he was tackling a very much like a spiritual philosophical issue in a time when that wasn't necessarily the overt academic norm,
right.
to write necessarily very oblique political things.
Right. And I wonder, I mean, I don't know.
But that's why it's satisfying to me now that something like this, and I think now we can go into talking more about what you were talking about with blockbuster things. It seemed to awaken an era within movies that things could be really epic and the capital H heroes and stuff like that.
Right.
But I don't want
to. No, it's cool.
Ruin your whatever point you were.
I don't know if there are any people out there doing podcasts or writing on that level again, where they are considering the issues now in a spiritual or philosophical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But I missed that.
Mm-hmm.
When Lewis got on the radio and did Mere Christianity, he wasn't doing this as like an attack on any specific political regime. He wasn't trying mm-hmm. to be like, you know, it's this kind of person that's the problem. It's like, no, let's all examine our hearts and look at what this is really
mm-hmm.
and decide in your mind and in you, you know, yourself personally, if this would fix things, kind of, you know what I mean? Not fix things, but like,
yeah, because I think that's what made Jordan Peterson so appealing to me is that
a lot of people, because it's the first one who's coming out and doing that again. Like, let's mm-hmm. talk about the philosophy of each individual of us and see why society is not a thing that makes decisions. You are a thing that makes decisions
mm-hmm.
and what your decisions you make is what makes society what it is. If people have this concept now that it's society that's making these decisions, and it's not.
Mm.
It's individuals.
Mm. He certainly hates Marxists, though. he's not shy about that.
No.
But it seems like I think there's an argument to be made, like there's a gradient that he's on, and I seem to like more that he's moderate about that, about trying to make it a more clinical psychological issue than a whole, like, blaming society for your problems. Certainly the Inklings as a writing group, it seems like they were encouraging them to selves and each other to return to an older form of storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that the fact that it's now a really popular one, we're getting like an Amazon prequel series to Lord of the Rings.
And a Tolkien biopic coming mm-hmm. soon, which yes. is kind of exciting.
we're going to have to go for a break.
Break time.
And then we'll go talk about the current zeitgeist of fantasy and how it is Tolkien and how it is not. So this is my personal hobby horse, and I brought this up with numerous things that we've watched where J.J. Abrams seems to be like the current, like, he's sitting on the Iron Throne of sci-fi and fantasy right now. And he has a very particular style of, that he's talked about is the mystery box formula, where you hide these, like, crucial pieces of information. And, well, as somebody that likes Lost, I can't necessarily, like, put myself on a pedestal of, like, I'm, you know, what's that pokey attack is not effective. Talk like these kids today. Anyway, but it is like there are certain stories that I think are set up very well. Like in Lost, I loved like 86% of those characters. It's a lot of characters. So every now and again, they're not going to be the best. There are certain things like that are really good. And then you get to some of the later Cloverfield movies and, some of the Star Trek movies where you need to have some substance underneath that mystery. There need to be characters that aren't like cardboard cutouts, you know. So what I like about Tolkien is that he makes these epic stories where each character is meaningful within this large umbrella of, you know, the world that he's creating. So many of the sci-fi fantasy stuff that I see now, they seem to think they're cool and like creating like, oh, this is this weird mysterious thing that has some semblance, like they're trying to do this magic trick where like there's this thing hidden behind, you know, the hidden in the box, and make it seem like it's the most important thing in the world. And rather than building up the characters, they're focused on this mystery that they're creating. And there's not, it's not the stuff, the style of the show or the style of the novel is not always good enough to make me care about what they're keeping under wraps. And it seems like because of our serialized stories based on comics, based on, you know, making, you know, trilogies or quadrilogies or, you know, what have you, you have these things that are there. They take this basic premise and they draw them out, and they try to create a semblance of change in the characters from one point to another. And it's so amazing to me that J.R.R. Tolkien created such a big universe, and it seems like no matter what point you enter within this larger story, there's always this, like, you know, it seems like a story that could be told by a Norseman. And,
right. Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, this is important because, you know, this person is like, you know, it speaks to this deeper level of humanity, like you were talking about. But I want to put that as like a question, like what else about this new era of the blockbuster makes it different or the same as, or is influenced by Tolkien? Because I brought up Game of Thrones.
So I have, I feel like I have such a limited exposure to fantasy, even though I have read more than you have. Because there's so much of it now. Like, so much of it.
Right.
And I have this weird feeling
that,
like,
in my opinion, most of it is
well, no,
not worth.
That's what I'm saying. Most of it, to me, feels like they all wish they were Tolkien. Right? And don't do much of a job of, like, doing their own work. They're just like, oh, well, we can slap a vague storyline inside of this kind of world and not have to do a lot of work for it.
Like, somebody, that Hello Future Me guy brought up, the Shannara Chronicles, that was one
the
where...
The show? Yes. The show was ridiculous.
Did you read the novels? Because I
have read some of them, yes. And the series I read was not bad. Because he did do, there was other stuff going on. It wasn't just a straight, you know.
They certainly made it seem like a CW teenage drama.
The TV show, yes. The TV show was like, why are we doing this?
Like basically like something like The Hunger Games. And I like The Hunger Games, but they were making this trial seem super important. But then to your credit, you were saying like, why are they focused on this weird, like very Maze Runner like thing? When, if we don't keep an eye on this tree,
yeah, I'm like, okay. And the premise of your show is that the elves forgot to tell the next generation that, oh, by the way, if this tree dies,
don't yell at the microphone.
Sorry. If this tree
dies, he didn't
do
anything.
All the demons that ever existed are going to be released into the world. Like, this is a kind of thing you think you would tell your kids.
Yeah.
What?
That's that mystery box thing I was talking about.
It was just weird. I'm like, what? It's good, but the books were actually pretty good. He tends to have like a, he also has like a, I haven't read it yet, but there's like a druid centered one where it's this really cool druid guy who
should add that
character
to the list.
Yeah.
But what's the name of the author?
Terry Brooks.
Terry Brooks, okay.
But he actually put a lot of work into like what his magic system was and what the history of the world was and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not hating on those at all. Mm-hmm. Brandon Sanderson's another one that does a lot of really good world-building stuff. He also has a good set of rules about magic that he's fairly famous for. I mean, I know I have read Tolkien wannabe stuff, and I promptly forgot the names of the authors.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I was going to bring up that it seems to me like the density of Tolkien is carried through in George R. R. Martin's stuff. But
from what I understand, yes.
But the philosophy of it couldn't be any more
different.
It's,
yes.
It's much more about the ambiguity of good and evil, where Tolkien very much had this
very definite good and evil.
Definite good and evil. And there's certainly, like, you're on a place on this gradient But to me, like, somebody like the Night King, if you're going to go back to what I was saying about the Dark Lord thing, somebody like Vader is very much like, I'm tempting you to do the wrong thing, versus the Night King, who is just...
I'm going to kill you all.
Yeah, and so it is returning to some semblance of, like, folktale in that death is a character, death is embodied in this thing, winter is coming, and all those sorts of things that remind people of these old fantasy, like, these old folktale stories, these old fairy tale stories, but it's very much taking a different approach in terms of it's this ensemble, almost like reality show, where everybody's just vying for their own power, and there are certainly noble people in it that are suffering deeply to do the noble thing, but it's much more in line with what we were talking about with what came after World War II of this, like, nihilism is this, you know, strong, powerful force that sometimes gets people to do unspeakable things in order to survive.
Yeah.
Much more like survivalist.
Right, as opposed to
things.
Trying to save what is good about the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like I said, I haven't really read tons, because, like, I'll start reading things, and if they just come across as Tolkien fan fiction,
mm-hmm.
then I'm just kind of like, eh.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I want to read more Brandon Sanderson, because he's very good at,
mm-hmm.
and also doing that thing where each character matters in
mm-hmm.
this bigger, huge story.
Okay. I guess that's another thing you would say is that, it's kind of what I was bringing up with the serialized story format, is that with so many of these things getting made into these big blockbuster movies, you can kind of see how taking one premise, like, say, like Hunger Games, for example, is there is a game, and each episode of this three-part saga is a different type of game.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit more of, like, political subterfuge at the end of the last one. But generally, that's kind of a format. And so I certainly liked that novel series. I feel like Suzanne Collins was doing a lot to prepare young adult readers for adult readership and tackling really good topics or really good ideas in a way that was easily understood, but not talking down to the
right.
to her readers. You can certainly, I think, make a case that with a lot of people after that were trying to mimic her stories and saw it as, oh, we just make these things where, you know, kids are in peril, and then that's all you need to do.
Right. And it's like, no, you don't not just need to have elves and dwarves and maybe dragons and a Dark Lord. Like, that's not all that was going on
mm-hmm.
in Lord of the Rings.
Right. So that epic thing that Tolkien was doing, it wasn't just putting people in perilous situations. He structured different things to be symmetrical. He invented, you know, whole languages. And one of my favorite things as well was he really valued and the like, in as much as his stuff wasn't like emotional in the traditional sense, I think a lot of 50s authors were not necessarily as maybe in touch with their emotions. I mean, to their credit, they were in trenches, so
right.
It's not easy for them to do. But they're like things like they go to the door in Moria, and you have to say "friend," like that as a commentary on what he feels like is this a good kingdom. Friendship is valuable.
Yeah,
and you have this, you know, relationship between kingdoms where all that somebody has to do is go up to your door and say, I'm a friend, and they're allowed in. And different friendships, like between Gimli and Legolas, between Frodo and Sam, even though it's this big, epic journey, you're not losing this very personal connection with these
right,
characters.
Right. I loved very much that he did that.
Mm.
I also very much appreciated the value of the humble
mm.
and small things.
Right.
The reason it has to be a hobbit that takes the ring to the mountain is because anybody with any kind of power at all would have destroyed the world.
Right?
Like, heaven forbid if Gandalf had actually been tempted at the beginning of that story to take that thing, because he would have become the Dark Lord very quickly, because Gandalf is not of this world and is incredibly powerful and would have ever been the end of it. Same thing if Galadriel had taken it. Same thing if Aragorn, to anybody who had any kind of power at all, would have ruined everything. Mm-hmm. And the fact that these little farmer dudes from X corner of the world are the ones that are willing to even take it, because they know they're just little hobbits. Like, what am I going to do? What if so Frodo took the ring. Great. What's that going to be? Yes, okay, so he can be invisible for a bit. But seriously, it's going to take him a long time. Even Gollum had it for how long? And he was creepy, yeah. But he wasn't the Dark Lord, right? Like, he didn't become the new destroyer of the Earth. And Frodo wouldn't have either. They would have figured out something. But, like, yeah. So, yeah,
I think a way to, another way to express that, and to wrap up, I'm trying to think if there was anything I wanted to add, but hooking off of that idea of humility, somebody like, say, Dumbledore in Harry Potter, as much as there were elements of that spoke to many people, personally, when Dumbledore dies, I didn't feel nearly as attached to that character as I did to Gandalf.
Right, because when Gandalf falls off that bridge,
there were people
in the movie theater crying.
Yeah.
Like, screaming at the movie, like, what?
I don't know which showing it was. It might have been the fifth time that I watched it.
Especially people that hadn't read it. Like, you could tell who had read the books and who hadn't, because there were people in the audience like, what? Like, freaking out. I'm like, guys, chill. He's fine.
What was interesting is that you would think somebody like him that didn't like allegory would be scared to death of making his thing seem like this super... Christ figure-y saying. What's interesting about that is that you get to know Gandalf as this, like, friend to the hobbits, and there's this idea of, like, this is this nice protected community, and yet these people, like, starting with the hobbit, you know, Bilbo has to become a thief in order to...
Right, they have to be more than what they are.
Right, and so what's interesting is that that's not... Like, we're going to get more into this in On Fairies, but he talks about the royalty being at a nexus of the fray world, being part of what he calls, like, the stew of it. But in a lot of, like, in, say, like, Game of Thrones, the important thing is to get the Iron Throne. What's interesting about Tolkien's thing is that, yes, he's showing how to be a noble king, how to be this wise wizard, but... the people that save all of, you know, Middle Earth are these humble hobbit figures. And there's this idea of needing to be humble and needing to be weak. And those being something that will.
And considering that you're your strength, it's not so much that they're weak, because they're not. They're able to withstand the ring for a great deal longer than anybody else.
Right.
The fact that Frodo could carry it that long and not get corrupted until he was in the heart of the evil kingdom was a big deal.
Right.
Nobody else could resist it like that.
Right.
The ring was like, well, what am I going to do with a hobbit? Like, you know, evil doesn't want this little...
Right. And as much as Tolkien didn't like to do allegorical things, it is a very Christian
principle. It's symbolic. That's the thing. They got hung up on terms, right? Because they were literature professors, and they knew what allegory meant, as opposed to most people nowadays who throw it around like any story that symbolizes something else is all automatically an allegory. It's not.
Right.
Allegories are very specific to types of stories, like Aesop's fables, where literally you have grace personified. Or you have, this is hunger, or this is death, and this is, you know, it's symbolized in your story directly, and it's a one-to-one ratio. Lord of the Rings has a lot of symbols in it, right? So Aragorn symbolizes Christ at times, or so does Gandalf, and the ring symbolizes evil, but it doesn't specifically say, oh, this is the atomic bomb.
Yeah, it's not Pilgrim's Progress.
Hitler. Or this is, right? It's not a specific, this is this evil. It is evil in general. And you can put a lot of different kinds of evil in that story and have it still work. Because it is symbolizing what evil does. It is tempting. It is powerful. It is planning, right? Like, it has this plan of how it's going to take over the world.
Uh-huh.
And evil in general, it's like a higher version of evil, mm-hmm. as opposed to the specific type of evil that I'm going to vilify in this story,
right.
if I'm trying to be allegorical about mm-hmm. it.
And I think to summarize my point about what makes Gandalf like this Christ-like thing is that rather than just do that token sacrifice my life for the good plan or good thing, like, you know, Dumbledore's a good example of that. I think in the last episode of Game of Thrones, where Bran is just kind of waxing philosophical for 3 episodes, and then
yeah.
all of a sudden he's there as what looks like he's going to sacrifice himself in some way. Gandalf had all these this meaningful connection with very, you know, if you want to look at them as like poor compared to the elves, if you want to look at them as less powerful in terms of their physical stature and strength, he has this very deep connection with them, and his wisdom is shown through connection with the small and the weak and the
yeah.
humble. And then he has to sacrifice, and it means so much more because he is actually giving up a certain level of connection with these people that he's with.
Right, because when he comes back, he's different.
Right. And so that's another major theme in his stories is that there's this sacrifice and you're different on the other side, but it was still worth it to make that sacrifice. So it's another interesting thing.
I do like that.
There's a lot to delve into.
Oh, so many things.
This month in terms of Tolkien. We're going to be back next week with the Tolkien movie, and hopefully we'll get some of this great nerdy goodness from that. and it won't just be a... although I, you know, even though Song of Achilles was a bad romance story, I don't want to crap all over the whole genre. But there are certain things as fans that we want to see within a Tolkien movie. Hopefully C.S. Lewis is in it. Hopefully they show his, some of what he was trying to do within the fantasy genre. And what I'm hoping is it's much like with his writing, you get through his personal connection with his wife and his friends, this idea of what he brought to them in his writing, like this very personal connection and his wisdom being integrated within his relationship, not being like a Steve Jobs-esque person who's like, you know, so domineering that he's not able to have personal connections.
Hopefully they don't mess him up.
Yeah. so that's next week. And then we're going to be jumping into On Fairies at the end of the month. So please join us then. And be part of the conversation on Twitter and Facebook. We're at Unboxing Story on the Twitters and the Facebooks. And we're also at John Matos Writer on all things.
And I am mostly Montost. Not mostly. I am Montost on most things.
And then Montost _Mel.
Yes,
on Twitter.
On Twitter.
Because eventually when we get enough money, we're going to try to do a bidding war on Mom Toast because you can do that. You can pay somebody money to give up their screen name if somebody gets something before.
Oh, on Twitter, you mean?
Yeah. That's a big thing for like people
that buy. Well, for all I know, it's me that I signed up like 12 years ago and I don't remember the password.
That would be interesting. Is that a theme within Tolkien? Like,
that's my former name. I was Mom Toast the Gray. Now I'm Mom Toast the White.
Jiminy Cricket. You can also, if for some reason you want to email us at unboxingstorypodcast@gmail.com, you can do that. We would certainly appreciate it.
Yes.
And if you have anything specific you want
about
us to bring
Tolkien
up.
Or Lewis, because we'll probably be doing some Lewis stuff too.
Yeah, those are the heavy hitters we're going to get to.
John's going to make me watch Shadowlands again, and I'm going to cry like a baby.
yeah, because I haven't seen the Shadows Wars.
Don't do that. Do not desecrate that name like that, you villain.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening. And we'll talk to you again later. Peace. You're not going to do your
bye. Bye.
There you go.